Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Thank you for joining us today at the Council on Foreign Relations for an on-the-record call on making sense of China's markets. I'm Robert Kahn, Stephen A. Tannenbaum Senior Fellow for International Economics here at CFR. And I'm pleased to be able to participate in this timely and important call. We are honored today to be joined by Patrick Chovanec, Managing Director and Chief Strategist at Silvercrest Asset Management. Patrick has a long and distinguished history of involvement in China as an educator and investor. He has taught at Tsinghua University School of Economics and Management in Beijing, was Director of Institutional Investors Asia Pacific Institute, and has studied China as a market participant for many years. Patrick also teaches part-time and is an adjunct professor at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs. Patrick and I will talk for probably about 15, 20 minutes and then open the floor for questions and discussion. So, Patrick, let me lead off. While many of us have been captivated by the drama playing out in Athens and Brussels, there have been economic tremors of potentially far greater consequence in Chinese markets. That was underscored this morning by the IMF, when they released a new economic forecast that shows a material marking down of their outlook and highlights the distribution of risks to global economic activity still tilted to the downside, and including increased financial market volatility and disruptive asset price shifts. And they no doubt have a close eye on China and the difficulties that the government faces in a transition to a new growth model in expressing those concerns. We have seen roughly, by some accounts, $4 trillion in paper value taken off the Chinese market, and while today seems to be a somewhat better day, it certainly there are questions about the durability and the sustainability of those of that news. So against that backdrop, can you get us started today by explaining in broad terms where we are and how we got here?
Yes, thank you very much, and thank you for having me. It is finally last night I was able to get a full night of sleep. I've been operating at both New York time, where I am, and China time for the past several days, if not over a week. And it has been a very interesting set of days. We've seen an unprecedented, if we were a couple weeks ago talking about the sort of measures that China has taken to try to shore up the market, I don't think people would have believed it, and it has really been something remarkable. Also, the size of this sell-off, you mentioned around $4 trillion. Just to put that in context, I've also seen a number that that the total losses in the dot-com bubble when that burst was $5 trillion. So, you know, this is a comparable sort of bubble bursting. So what happened? There is, I would say that there are two stories here, and it's a story, and this is really a tale of the disconnect between those two different stories. The first story is the story of the Chinese economy and where it's at, and the second is what's happened to the stock market in China over the past year. China's economy is going through a difficult adjustment period between the kind of growth that relies on investment and exports to drive growth, and a greater balance between consumption and investment. And this has been something that they've said is taking place and needs to take place. But it has been a difficult path, and the Chinese economy has slowed significantly over the past few years and over the past year. GDP growth in China, although you often hear it was 7%, that's a year-on-year number. Actually, the quarter-on-quarter growth in China, according to official statistics, in the first quarter was 5.3%, which by anyone's definition of a few years ago is a hard landing. And there are a lot of people who doubt that that number even does justice to the severity of the downturn in China. And corporate earnings have also reflected this. They have declined, and in fact, they would have declined even more if Chinese companies had not been simultaneously recognizing So that's the other thing that took place over the past year, which is just at the time that the Chinese economy was deteriorating, corporate earnings were deteriorating, the Chinese stock market took off like a rocket and nearly tripled in value in the past year. And valuation, since corporate earnings weren't rising, valuation skyrocketed as well. At the peak, the median valuation in the Shanghai and Shenzhen stock market was about 85 times price to earnings. That means that half of those companies were trading at above 85, which is astonishing. And we're not talking here about just the growth board. The growth board was well above 100 into the 150 range. We're talking traditional old line companies that normally would be trading somewhere between 10 and 20 times. So the valuations were extremely high. There were two reasons that people gave for why those valuations would continue to rise regardless of the fundamentals. The first was that the government would ensure that the market did not fall. And then the second was that major indices, the producer of the major indices like MSCI, were going to add Chinese domestic A shares to their global indices, particularly the MSCI Emerging Market Index, and that this would, the decision was going to take place in June, and that this would cause a lot of money managers around the world, both passive and active, to allocate into China, regardless of what the prices were, and that there would be a surge of money flowing in, and that would raise the market further. MSCI made the decision in early June that it would not add Chinese shares. So that took some of the wind out of the sails, and very soon after, we started to see corporate insiders beginning to sell off. And the thing that really took hold at that point was margin lending. One of the things that added rocket fuel to this was an unprecedented explosion in margin lending. Right? Just to give you an idea, right now on the New York Stock Exchange, margin lending accounts for about 2.5%. The overall market float. By the peak, it had reached in China 12%, 3.5% of GDP, which, according to Goldman Sachs, was both of those were the highest ever recorded on any market ever. And margin lending is great to add rocket fuel when the prices are going up, but it also creates a death spiral when prices begin to go down and people are forced to, when prices go down, sell their shares, which then pushes prices down further and causes more market calls. So that's one of the margin calls. That's one of the things that we have seen unfold. And it's not just margin lending through securities firms, formal margin lending, but it's also margin lending through what we call the shadow banking channels in China. That is investment funds lending to people to buy shares. Even state-owned enterprises lending to people to buy shares. So it was a very, very kind of complex and fragile picture that began to unravel a couple weeks ago. The market is down about 30%. We can talk in greater detail about, and I think you'll want to talk in greater detail about some of the measures that the Chinese government has taken to try to keep the market from falling down further. We can also talk about why they wanted to do that, because this is not the first time we've seen a bubble rise and burst in the Chinese stock market. Back in 2007, the 12 months leading to October 2007, the Shanghai Composite Index tripled. And then in the following 12 months before the global financial crisis took hold, collapsed by 70%, which essentially eliminated all of its gains. At that time, the government did not choose to intervene, and the effects were actually not that bad in terms of its effect either on the Chinese economy or on the global economy. So we can talk a little bit more about why they chose to intervene now, the extent of that intervention, and some of the tools that they've used, and whether or not it will be effective. Do you want me to just go ahead and talk about that, or do you want to
Yeah, well, I think that's great. Why don't we go on? You know, why don't you go on and talk a little bit more about those tools and why this time is different in that sense from past interventions?
Okay. So there are really five different tools. It's a complex array of tools that they have tried to employ. The first has been simple monetary easing. This is what happened actually 2 weekends ago. Throughout this stock market bubble, whenever the market looked shaky, and sometimes it did look shaky, and usually the reason why it started to look shaky and even saw a 5% drop on a given day was because there were rumors of the authorities going to rein in margin lending. So whenever there was talk of reining in margin lending, the market fell. And usually the response was to, first of all, disavow those rumors, and the second thing would be that the PBOC, China Central Bank, stepped in at several points and said, we are cutting interest rates, we are cutting reserve requirements, and we're going to be injecting more money into the economy. It was not clear whether those were actually net easing, because there were also outflows of capital from China at that time. So it may have just said compensated for that, but the market perceived it as easing, and that easing would then flow into the stock market. They tried this. This was their first response about 2 weeks ago when the market started falling, and they cut interest rates. They cut the reserve ratio. We're actually both of them for the first time together, and the market didn't respond. It continued to fall. They have continued to announce easing measures, and it remains part of their repertoire, but that it hasn't really proven that effective. The second is removing restrictions on margin lending. Now, it's kind of ironic because all along they realized that margin lending was way out of control and have always talked about how they could rein it in because they saw it as very risky. But when the stock market began to fall, one of the things that they started to do is just lift restrictions on margin lending, and that includes both lifting the requirements for brokers to have margin calls when stocks fell below a certain price. They just waived that entirely. They also allowed people to pledge different kinds of collateral other than their shares, so they could pledge their home, for instance, or they could pledge anything that the brokers were willing to accept. It's not clear what brokers are willing to accept. And the other thing is that they were going to encourage and create ways for brokers to securitize their existing margin loans, sell them to the public, and then turn around and make more margin loans, which ought to strike people as kind of reminiscent of subprime. But all of these things were an attempt to sort of get off the downward cycle of margin calls and then try to boost the market again. It's not necessarily effective because people have to want to borrow to buy. And if people are not interested in buying and because prices are going down, there's not that much demand for margin loans. So we've actually seen margin loans have fallen because of the margin calls significantly by about a third over the past two or three weeks. But stock prices have fallen faster than margin lending. So actually the latest numbers that I saw just yesterday is that margin lending has risen to 16% of the market flow. It's kind of what happens with Greek debt. You know, when you can cut the debt, but if the GDP falls, then you actually end up with a higher debt-to-GDP ratio than before, and that's sort of what's happening with the margin lending in China. The third is stepping in with direct buying. I mean, China has a lot of state-owned enterprises, has a lot of vehicles through which they can just tell them, go in and buy, and they have. The problem is that it's tended to focus on very large caps, and it did not, and although it may have boosted a few shares, it did not restore confidence to the overall market. So people, we would see a few, like on Monday, when they started to do this intensely, the Shanghai Index actually rose, but two shares fell for every one that rose because the buying was so concentrated, and that actually undermined confidence in the market. And then the fourth would be selling restrictions. Just in the past 48 hours, they've announced that anyone who is a significant shareholder, meaning more than 5%, cannot sell their shares for the next 6 months. So pretty dramatic step there. And also any insiders who sold their shares recently are supposed to buy them back. I don't know how they're going to hunt me for that. So basically giving people orders to stop selling and start buying. And then the fifth, which is very interesting and very significant for interpreting what happened last night, is mass suspensions of trading. Right now, I've seen different numbers, somewhere between 1,500, 1,600 stocks on Shanghai and Shenzhen are now in suspended trading at the request of the company. So about half of the shares, maybe even more than that, are not trading and did not trade yesterday at all. Initially, that was interpreted as simply these companies were seeking a safe harbor and the regulators were giving it to them. But more kind of research into this reveals that actually one of the triggers here is that Chinese companies tend to use their shares as collateral, and the shares of management and the shares of insiders as collateral for getting loans from banks, either to the company or personal loans. So people pledge their shares as personal loans. And then they're getting margin calls now. And if those insiders, if those owners have to liquidate their shares, they will no longer be in control of the company. That's a change of ownership, and that leads to a trading suspension. So, I mean, that's pretty stunning if you think about it, that, you know, about half the companies that are listed on the exchange have suspended trading, possibly because the shares have been pledged and the owners have lost control of their companies. So that's pretty dramatic, and it's important when you look at what happened yesterday with the bounce back in shares in Shanghai and Shenzhen. All of these buying measures were in place. And at least half the market was closed. So, I mean, if you order people not to sell, if you tell people to buy, and then if you shut down the trading of stocks that have been losers, what's going to happen to prices? They're probably going to rise. But effectively, I tweeted yesterday, and it got picked up in the media and actually used as a headline for some of the articles. I said that playing on, you know, the old expression in Vietnam was we had to destroy the village in order to save it. And I said China had to destroy the stock market in order to save it. And it essentially has shut down much of the stock market in order to get the bump in prices that we saw yesterday.
And so since my next question is going to be what happens next, is it right, and so I know it's an unfair question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. It does seem to me what you're describing, you described this sort of epic bubble, extraordinary support, but selling restrictions, suspension of trading, all of these are designed to prevent the adjustment to the bursting of the bubble, right? You're not leaving, it doesn't sound like you're leaving us with a lot of confidence that we're far along in the adjustment or that this price increase is durable. So what happens next?
So two real questions there. The first is what happens in the market, and the second is what happens in the economy, including the global economy. The first thing is what happens to the market. I think that, you know, yeah, they could shut down the market, I mean, effectively. And if they shut down the market, prices, you know, are more easily manipulable and they don't really reflect reality. It's no longer a market. So the end of market crisis if there's no more market. But that is a real step back for a lot of things that China wanted to do in terms of both for its own sake, you know, increasing accountability with the financial system, more efficient allocation of capital, using, you know, developing capital markets further, and also, you know, for some of the things that it wanted to do to encourage the internationalization of RMB, more capital inflows into China. I mean, you know, have that conversation about whether A shares should be included in global indices today. How could you possibly include A shares in global indices today when half of them are not trading? And they're liable to cease trading if the market goes down. You can't get in and out of stocks. They're not investable then. So, you know, that whole goal, which you know, China put a lot of emphasis on, of becoming essentially an international financial center, has seen a real setback. The bigger question, I think, that in some ways is more important for people who aren't just focused on China, is what is the impact on the Chinese economy and what is the impact on the rest of the world's economy, because it's number two economy in the world. I would say that China's stock market bubble and the bursting of that bubble is more of a symptom than a cause of China's economic troubles. You know, China does have economic troubles. Those troubles have been underway for some time. They've had an effect on a lot of things, including China's, if you look at China's commodity imports over the past 2 months, they have really taken a huge hit, and it's been reflected in the price of global commodities. It's been reflected in, it's hit countries like Australia very hard. So, for instance, you know, yesterday there was talk about contagion. Well, this was when the market was still going down, they were talking about contagion, and people would point to the price of oil, they would point to the price of iron ore, they would point to the price of copper and the Australian dollar. And I would say this is not so much contagion as something, things that were directly implicated in China's economic story, and that the, for a long time, people were able to kind of ignore a lot of the bad news out of China, or at least shrug it off and say, well, you know, the stock market's doing really well, so something must be going well, and they must be on the verge of rebound or something. And now they kind of have to face more squarely with the reality of China's slowdown. But that slowdown was well underway, and quite frankly, a lot of these losses are paper losses. There may be, because of all the margin lending, financial ripple effects and potential financial instability. I would argue that the better way of dealing with that, instead of trying to prop up the entire market, would be to try to identify at-risk institutions and do what can be done to shore them up, or at least, you know, protect them from a cascade of defaults. I mean, people sometimes compare China's intervention to TARP. That's not really correct, because TARP wasn't trying to keep share prices from falling. It was trying to just contain the consequences of that fall. And it's a lot easier to contain those consequences when you just identify core institutions that would present a systemic risk. But you know, there may be some effect. There may be a effect in the short run on Chinese consumption, because there's a wealth effect, people perceive that they're poorer. But again, these were paper losses. You know, people were three times as wealthy as they were, and then suddenly they weren't. So it wasn't as though, you know, somehow the Chinese economy suddenly fell off a cliff. The Chinese economy had troubles, but it didn't suddenly fall off a cliff, and it isn't going to cause it to fall off a cliff, unless they keep on intervening in really, you know, risky and destructive ways. The impact on the global economy, I would just say that the adjustment that China is going through that is so painful and so difficult is actually one that it needs to go through, and one that will ultimately be good for the global economy. It'll be good for the Chinese economy, it'll be good for the global economy. It doesn't mean it's not a painful path, but, you know, this is not, China's adjustment is not the thing we should fear. It's the thing we've been waiting for. Because a lot of the growth that, and this is kind of hard to wrap our minds around, because we usually think all growth is good growth. And if anywhere in the world growth slows, well, then that's bad for the global economy. But a lot of the growth that was taking place in China was not good growth. It was actually very counterproductive, because while it may have been boosting input prices, things like iron and copper ore, especially iron ore and copper and oil and other things, it was going into this massive capacity build-out that was actually deflating prices for outputs around the world. And a classic example of that was the solar sector, where China built out this huge capacity that basically drove down prices below cost and drove foreign companies out of the business before they drove themselves out of the business to collapse. And so, you know, the end of China's investment boom, it will deflate input prices, and we already see it deflating input prices, but eventually reining in that overcapacity will help reflate the prices of things that the United States, for instance, produces. It depends on what sector you're in, and it depends on how much you've been feeding into China's investment boom. But fundamentally, I think that this is part of a rebalancing that needs to take place in the global economy. Another way to put it, by the way, to understand this, is that, you know, China, we normally, when there are when there are financial crises around the world, they normally happen in deficit countries, countries which are debtors. And the effect is, because they're debtors, that when their output slows, their consumption has to slow as well, because they don't have much savings. They're borrowing. And if people aren't willing to borrow, lend to them more, then they have to stop consuming. And that's exactly what's taking place in Greece right now. But crises can also happen in surplus countries. And China is a surplus country that has produced more than it's consumed for years. It has accumulated $4 trillion worth of reserves. There's a lot of misunderstanding about what those reserves are good for. They're not good for bailing out the stock market. They're not good for bailing out the domestic economy or boosting output. That money is already in the Chinese economy in the form of renminbi. It's what financed the investment boom. But it does represent claims on other countries and goods and services. So what China could do is, and I think it will have to do at some point, is run deficits to support consumption in the face of an otherwise very difficult economic adjustment. That's good for China because they don't have to suffer as much as they normally would through this kind of economic adjustment. And it's also good for the world because it creates net demand.
So you haven't given up on rebalancing. You haven't given up on rebalancing. It's a long
time. No, look, rebalancing is going to happen, and it's either going to happen in a pretty way or another way. One way of rebalancing is that Chinese consumption rises to the fore and everything, wonderful. The other way that rebalancing can happen is that Chinese output and Chinese investment collapses and consumption remains resilient because they can afford to draw down their reserves. Now, I would rather have the former than the latter. But both of them open up net demand in the global economy. And both of them, let me just add this. In 1990, Japan had both a stock market and property crash, and then also a whole decade, maybe two decades of lost growth. And this was, it's easy to kind of brush that aside because we know the history, but at the time, that was the second largest economy in the world, it's the fastest growing economy in the world, and all of a sudden it just came to a halt. It did not derail growth globally. It did not derail growth in the United States. Why? Because it hadn't been really driving growth in the United States. Japanese growth had been surplus-driven growth that was driven off of the U.S. consumer. And I'm not framing that in a way to say that's unfair. It's just that was the model. And then when that growth slowed, unfortunately, they didn't make an adjustment to more consumption-driven economy. It's just struggling with that. But it didn't derail the rest of the world because the rest of the world really wasn't deriving growth from the Japanese consumer, the Japanese market. And so they kind of went on their way. I would have been better if Japan had gotten out of its malaise and been a growth driver, but it did not derail growth in a way that a lot of people look at China right now and fear that slower growth will translate to slower global growth.
So you've given us a great overview and put a lot of issues on the table. Justin, can you read the instructions about how to bring everyone else into the conversation?
Yes, sir. At this time, we'll open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, just press star 2. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 now. We are currently holding for questions.
Patrick, while we're waiting for the questions to come in, in thinking a little bit about your comments on this whole process of market liberalization and how it's been affected or how you would change the story now, one big piece of this is the role of the People's Bank, as a lender of last resort, as a leader of the effort to reform the financial system and provide additional discipline. Does this episode lead to a fundamentally different role for the central bank than we expected before?
In crises, a lot of the rules go out the window, and you have people who have longer-term agendas of market liberalization, whatever, that then get brushed aside in order to deal with an immediate crisis. Now, the question, of course, is whether this was as big of a crisis that it required that kind of response. Actually, Taishin Magazine, which is a very prominent financial magazine in China, wrote a piece saying the government, the PBOC, should not have intervened, and that they should have let the market adjust as it did in 2007. And the that everyone would have been better off if they chose you. But they saw it as a crisis. They saw it as something that they could not allow to happen. And when I say they, who is they? The central bank in China is not an independent central bank. They can propose, but a council and the Politburo gets to dispose. They're the one to call the shot. And so maybe Zhou Xiaotong would have preferred to deal with this in a different way, and maybe if he was in charge, he would have dealt with it in a different way. But this was the response that folks in Beijing decided to go with, and I do think it does make it more difficult. I don't think it makes it impossible. I think it compromises some of the credibility, though, of making the market decisive, right? I mean, that was what came out of the third plenum document that everyone was very excited about a year and a half ago, that promised a lot of reforms, and it actually was used as justification for why the stock market should rise. The key theme there of like 60 proposed reforms, very few of which have actually materialized, was the market will be decisive. The market will be decisive because that will lead to more efficient allocation of resources. And clearly, the market is not decisive right now. The party is decisive, and I think that that's always been a tension that has existed. And this brought it out.
Okay. Justin, are there any questions in the queue?
Yes, sir. Our first question comes from Brian Ween with Blackstone Group.
Yeah. Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, great. My concern is the amount of debt that China has accumulated over the past 3 years. The debt-to-GDP ratio was relatively low. Now it's quite high. Does this limit the flexibility of their ability to take action to arrest some of the damage that's been done by the stock market collapse?
To the extent that they don't, again, I would say that the stock market collapse is sort of, icing on the cake, and the substance of the cake is this economic adjustment that China is going through, and that whole debt problem existed and has grown over the past several years and has been a growing concern and a growing problem. To the extent that they don't deal with the debt issue and deal in particular not just with the overall debt levels, but more importantly, what I think is the high percentage of that debt that is not performing, that is actually bad debt. To the extent that they don't deal with that, flush it out of the system, have people take losses on it, whether private losses or public losses, and get it out of the system, they have to roll that debt over. And when they roll that debt over, often they pay interest on it to pretend that it's good. And quite frankly, a lot of the assets, I would argue, in the shadow banking system are precisely this, bad debt, bad assets that are being rolled over by promising people returns and then paying them returns. But what ends up happening is that means that when you expand the money supply in China, when you inject more money in, when you engage in easing, a lot of that gets eaten up by the need to pay interest on non-performing debt. And less of it translates into real economic growth. And so, you get to a point, I don't know whether they're there yet, where essentially all the money, you are dependent on injecting more and more money into the banking system, and it's all going to bad debt rather than growth. So it's a very serious problem that the only way they deal with it is by recognizing and accepting losses and then moving on from there. But nobody wants to do that.
Right. So doesn't this prolong the ultimate reckoning in China? Wouldn't it be better? I mean, all the things they've done, what you just described in terms of bad debt, what they're doing in terms of preventing IPOs, preventing executives from selling positions, criminalizing short sellers, all those things prevent the ultimate washout from taking place. Isn't that correct?
China wants a correction without having a correction. and I've said this many times about many different issues, whether it's the property market, whether it's local government debt, whether it is corporate debt, whether it's the stock market. China, very frequently, they say, we know there's a problem. We know that this can't continue. We know that we need to send signals to stop this from growing even bigger. Shadow banking is another example of that. And yet, to actually act in a consequential way has consequences. And those consequences are that people lose money, that investment slows, investment at least into, you know, areas that have traditionally been booming slows, and GDP falls, at least for a time, right? But ultimately, resources get reallocated in more effective directions. But they want a correction without having a correction, which is why they never have a correction.
Yeah, but they're running out of resources in order to prevent, right?
It's every time they do it, they have fewer and fewer resources to be able to do anything other than kick the can a little bit down the road. But you know, you can kick the can, but each time that you do it, you're still all that bad debt is still a drag on growth. And that's why growth, it has slowed significantly, and that's why the rally in China stocks wasn't sustainable. Because it didn't reflect what was really going on in the economy. And that's why I think we'll continue. And that's why I don't think that there's going to be a sudden turnaround in the Chinese economy. Because we're at the beginning of this process of restructuring and adjustment, not at the end.
Great. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Marcus Jank with the PwC.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thanks for the talk. I really appreciated it. My question would concern both opportunities for consumer investment because, you know, as you had mentioned in your speech, this is not the first time that the Shanghai Stock Exchange has experienced a precipitous fall. You know, many of my Chinese friends joke that investing in the Chinese stock market, you know, it just goes up and down and up and down, and people just kind of ride the wave and then pick up the pieces when it crashes. But now what kind of differentiates this a bit is that now we know that the property market is not great in China. We haven't, you know, there's not a large amount of growth there. So I'm wondering what your perspective is. If your average Chinese consumer with a bit of money to invest no longer wants to invest in the stock market because the stock market in China, for all the reasons you've mentioned, has proven unreliable time and year after year, and the property market is kind of seen as, you know, kind of like petered out in a sense. You know, where are consumers in China supposed to put their money now?
So there's really two questions here I see. The first is, what happens, you know, what happens in terms of consumer spending and saving patterns as a result of all this? And does it help boost consumption? Or, you know, are the Chinese just kind of stuck in a bunch of bad assets? You know, partly a solution to this would be to open the capital account and allow people in China to invest abroad and have a whole kind of international benchmark to what returns. Because one of the problems is that there's a lot of capital that has been bottled up in China pushes down returns. It may not push down perceived returns for a time, but it pushes down actual returns. And there's no benchmark. There's no alternative. And people just kind of accept. And it's called financial repression. And it's one of the ways that they're able to boost capacity expansion. But the problem is if you got all the capacity you need and want, then why would you want to do that? You know, whether people will go and spend more, I think the capacity of people in China to spend more is not just based upon household savings rates. It's really about the national savings rates because a lot of the savings that takes place in China is not talked about is at the corporate level. And that's why the problem is not so much that people have this money and they choose to save it to spend it. It's people, how Chinese households have a very small percentage of the overall national income, And that ends up reducing, no matter what their consumption or spending choices or saving choices are, that really reduces their capacity to spend. One of the things that does that, for instance, is an undervalued currency now. IMF has now said that the renminbi is overvalued. I would argue that it needs to be overvalued because that benefits consumers at the expense of producers, and it will reduce overcapacity and will boost consumption. So that's, you know, I think that there's an adjustment that needs to take place there, but there are a lot of moving pieces besides just sort of whether consumers want to save or spend. The bigger question is, are there things that are worth investing in China? You know, I've just painted a very bleak picture of sort of the macro picture and how it led to a stock market bubble. I think, yes, there are. There's a lot of areas in China where there's room for huge productivity gains in agriculture, in logistics, in healthcare, in the consumer economy, in retail, in services. It doesn't even require technology. There's this obsession in China with, you know, moving up the value chain in terms of technology, but a lot of these things just are, if you adopt business practices and create soft infrastructure, hard infrastructure, soft infrastructure that exists in developed markets, that you could really see massive productivity gains. But the resources have to go in that direction. And if you can make more money flipping land and build it by building high-end condos on it, models to meet those kind of critical needs. So that's, you know, one of the problems with bubbles, and I'm not just talking about stock bubble here, talking about bubble in real estate and other things like that, and investment, is that not just that prices go up and prices go down and people lose their shirts, it sucks the oxygen out of the rest of the economy, and resources which could have been deployed to really get the economy going in the right direction are deployed in a very different way. And I think that even some of these companies that have lost, you know, that were trading at ridiculous multiples and are now going to come down, some of them are maybe frauds, I don't know, you know, but a lot of them are good companies. I know one company, for instance, that I invested in back in, I was a private equity investor, and I'm not giving any way information to ancient history, but this was a company that made steel casting for equipment, and it was a good company, good solid management. It's a little bit of a difficult market now with the property slowdown, but I think they'll do well. They have the potential to do well. Yeah, but I checked about a month ago; they were trading at 120 times earnings. All right, this is a traditional industrial company in a difficult market environment, and it's trading at higher times. That makes no sense. That doesn't mean it's a fraud. It doesn't mean, you know, sometimes we have this binary view of either everything's good or everything's bad. It's perfectly good company. It's just that it needs a realistic valuation, because valuations like that actually hurt companies, because it completely distorts their, it distracts their focus, it distorts their decision making, and pushes them to do things that, and it actually limits a lot of their choices, that if they had a more reasonable valuation, they could make more rational, long-term choices that would build their business.
I think we might have time for one more quick question. Justin, are there any other calls, questions in the queue?
No, sir. I'm showing no more questions in the queue.
Okay. Well, then we will conclude on time, something we like to do. Thank Patrick for a great overview and discussion of an interesting complex issue. And from what you said today, one that is going to be with us for a while longer still. So we'll probably have opportunities again to continue to discuss this. But thank you very much. It was a great discussion, and we appreciated it very much.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.